Thursday, October 20th, I awoke early in Cobham Room in the Governor General's house, Wellington, New Zealand. At 6, I had coffee and read the papers, but I couldn't resist the urge to explore. The house was a big rambling frame structure, built, I think, in late Victorian days, sided with comfortable dignity and a long spread of rolling green lawn. The major rooms are named after former governor generals. I went to Newell Room and looked at paintings which they had gathered there. My preference was a watercolor. It shows the Victorian type houses, green and pink and white, on the steep sloping streets that look somehow like they were congealed in time, one of the Victorian decades. And comfortably, happily, nothing has changed. Somebody had quipped that Kipling was probably still a bestseller. I was filled with a sense of anticipation and excitement, didn't want to miss a moment, so I walked downstairs. On the stair landing, there's a big stained glass window, the Windsor Cress, Vieux et Mon Droit, and the great hall downstairs, Cress of the families of the former governors general. Sir Bernard is absolutely unbelievable. You could have walked right out of the pages of a book. Tall, erect, rubicund face, with a monocle and a bristly white mustache. He's too perfect to believe, a very proper model of a British governor general. His father had been governor general, and both of his grandfathers are perfectly cast. And Lady Ferguson, his wife, very slim and tall, assured and elegant. The side halls were lined with pictures of the former governor generals. The dining room chairs are done in needlepoint. Lady Ferguson told me it was part of the preparation for the long-ago planned visit of King George. Unfortunately, he became ill and did not come. But Queen Elizabeth saw the chairs when she came very much later, and those in the sitting room had been recovered in red leather, the crest of the crown on them. I had just started outdoors when Sir Bernard and Lady Ferguson joined me. They showed me the tennis court. My old friend, the Japanese cherry trees, were beautifully in bloom. There were lilacs and calendulas and calcellarias, and everything so well maintained. Sir Bernard said that the first British governor general to occupy the house had said loftily, "They call this a government house. I wouldn't even stable my horse here." For me, it looked quite splendid. It was a magnificent rhododendron tree, not a shrub, this, probably 20 feet tall and a mass of pinky lavender blossoms that would have made my Virginia friends wordless with envy. But then it was time to go in and see that tyrant of this trip, the hairdresser, and next to join Lyndon, Sir Bernard, and Lady Ferguson to meet the staff, who were lined up very properly by the front door. A civilized and pleasant custom, one of the many things I like about the British. Here I can scarcely say New Zealanders, because these people were so very British. Then we went into the drawing room to exchange gifts. Some really intuitive person had lit upon the idea of a copy of George Washington's ceremonial sword, which reposes in the Smithsonian, as a gift for Sir Bernard. They gave us encyclopedia about New Zealand and a charming watercolor. And then suddenly it was time to go. The wife of the Prime Minister, Mrs. Holyoake, and our ambassador's wife, Mrs. Powell, came for me. We made our goodbyes to Sir Bernard and Lady Ferguson. I hope that we shall meet again. Then we drove down the winding road from Government House, which was lined with school children, scrubbed, attentive, wholesome-looking, all in their uniforms, and out the gateway with its imposing arch, onto the road by the harbor. Things I will remember about Wellington. The harbor, the steep hills, with the bunches of white daisies and yellow broom, the purple flowers, all apparently wild, and great masses of flourishing wild nasturtiums and calla lilies in abundance. Nothing had prepared me for how pretty, how scenic it would be. Down the main street there's a median strip of Norfolk pine, which they call Christmas trees, and decorate for the season. And all the streets are lined with the Victorian type houses in pastel colors that really look like they've been the same for the last 6 decades. A pleasant country and content, or so it seemed, from a few hours' view, not goaded by any need for progress. I'd heard Mrs. Holyoake described as the perfect wife for a government official. She was a bit plump, comfortable, gracious, easy to be with, and our own Ambassador's wife, Mrs. Powell, had adapted herself to the country by learning to spin in this land of sheep and wool. How appropriate. She's a thorough advocate of New Zealand and a delightful woman. Our morning was planned around parks and flowers. We went to the Lady Norwood Rose Garden and Begonia House. They're on grounds that from 42 to 46 were Camp Anderson and housed several hundred American naval troops. The former mayor, who had come a poor immigrant to New Zealand and grown rich, had given the lovely Rose Garden and the Begonia House as a memorial to his wife, Lady Norwood. Mr. Archibald and Mr. Galloway took me through with the inhibiting accompaniment of a big galaxy of press, gave me a spray of orchids. We saw a wildflower exhibit of native New Zealand flora, and we saw a demonstration of what one could plant in one's own yard with assurance of success. Excellent idea. But I would have learned more and enjoyed more if I hadn't been on view myself. Then, as we drove around through the park, there were wonderful panoramic glimpses of the Blue Harbor and the hillsides and the city below us. We stopped at Carolburn Lookout for pictures of the great view, including some of the huge tree-like ferns. At one point, I made a few words talk, my appreciation and the presentation of a plaque, like my own, that says, "You are nearer to God in a garden than anywhere else on earth." And then, at the top of the hill, we boarded the cable car, a venerable sightseer's item, wood and shiny brass, and open windows that went down a breathtakingly steep track, the gorgeous view of the harbor below, for a very short ride, with the Secret Service men hanging on to the outside. It was gay, and at the bottom, there were about 5,000 people to welcome me. We made our way to the Powell's car, and at our embassy residence, I quickly changed clothes and joined Lyndon for what was the high point of our visit to New Zealand, the downtown motorcade to Civic Square. Of this, the press said, the staid city of Wellington gave him the warmest, most boisterous welcome in memory that a foreign head of state has received in New Zealand. 60,000 people lined the streets to see the president drive from Government House to Parliament in his open-top limousine this morning. Authorities said the crowd was bigger than that which turned out for Queen Elizabeth when she visited Wellington 3 years ago. Of course, Lyndon stood up in the car and waved and smiled and shouted and shook the hands within reach and did nothing to speed up the itinerary, so that it took us nearly an hour to drive to Parliament House, me being divided between enjoying what was obviously a wonderful welcome from these people we had been warned were very staid and cold, and on the other hand being uncomfortable about Mrs. Holyoake and her guests who were waiting for me at Wareham for our luncheon. That is not to say there were not objectors. Outside Parliament House there were a group of youngsters with signs, the now familiar, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?" and a surprising one so many thousands of miles from home, "Bobby Kennedy for president." And of course, withdrawal from Vietnam. But they were about 500 in number, according to the police, as against the 60,000 shouting happy greetings. At last it was over. Lyndon was out and headed inside for the state luncheon, with apologies for being delayed by the graciousness of the people of Wellington. And in a few moments I was at Wareham, an attractive, unpretentious house set in a pretty garden, for a luncheon hosted by Mrs. Holyoake and attended by the wives of ministers, government officials, and a few from the diplomatic corps, including my old friend Miranda White from the International Club days. His husband is now acting Secretary of External Affairs. And we had a nice talk about the Senate wives and housewives we'd known together. This luncheon could have taken place almost anywhere. Beautiful flower arrangements. It's so thoughtful to work on them, because word has preceded me that I am interested in flowers. A whitefish patty. This is a land of the sea. And then some lamb. What else? And then a delightful dessert called pavlovas. White and elegant, with lovely red strawberries. And Mrs. Holyoake gave me a box made of Powell shell. And then back we went to Parliament House to join Lyndon. The luncheon was running late, and a little past three, I left with Lyndon for the airport. And the lovely drive along the harbor, with people still clapping and cheering. Nobody must have done business that day. I think the schools and the shops and the offices all emptied. At the airport, we said goodbye to Sir Francis and Lady Kitts. Seems like everybody is Lady this or that. And here once more, as in Jamaica, I had had that strange feeling of being being an imposter when I signed my name at the guest books that were everywhere. Lady Bird Johnson. We departed in a New Zealand airplane, the Prime Minister and Mrs. Holyoake, to the tune of 1,000 New Zealanders singing the Maori farewell, and Lyndon having one last foray into the crowd to the delight of the people. And when the papers say it was to the dismay of the security officers, they surely cannot have included the Americans, who are plenty used to it. On this 100-mile ride through Hakia Air Base, we had one of the quietest, most pleasant interludes of the visit, and I found that Prime Minister Holyoake is a botanist and a man of humor. We passed over the most beautiful, green, verdant country, and they said, look your last. When you get to Australia, it'll be all dry. There was a great swath of golden flowers on a mountainside, and they said they were black-eyed Susans. From Ohakia, we went by car across beautiful rolling countryside, lush farm country, to Sanson and the Ormond Wilson farm. The farms were divided into very small fields, paddocks, they call them, filled with the fattest sheep I've ever seen, and marked off sometimes by fences, sometimes by a very thick, impenetrable hedge of gorse, which I soon learned was a curse to the farmers, but has beautiful yellow flowers. They told me that only 15 years ago, or thereabouts, this was wild pasture land covered with gorse. They'd gotten rid of it with bulldozers, had fertilized and seeded with low-flying planes, and transformed it into very rich farmlands for the most productive sheep I've ever seen. By this time, we were so far behind schedule that we were bent on cutting out everything possible. To my regret, because I would have loved to have seen more of the farm, we only saw the sheep shed and the very nice couple, Mr. and Mrs. Ormond Wilson, who took us in, and we watched a precision operation, a farm worker gripping a sheep magically with his knees and one hand, while with the other he operated electric shears that in less than 2 minutes cut the fleece off in one whole perfect pattern and left the sheep as naked as a newborn babe. He'd been just docile as a rag doll. The minute he was turned loose, he pitched and reared and ran out the chute, and you saw what skill it must have taken to hold him while he was being sheared. We watched about 3 sheep being sheared. Lyndon picked up a whole blanket of fleece. I touched it, and it was oily and very soft. Our sheep are indeed the poor relations of these. And then with waves and thanks and handshakes and special greeting to the children, we were back in the car, headed for Ohakia, passing crowds along the winding road, and by 5 o'clock, goodbye to the Holyoakes, and wheels up for Australia. There was a 3.5-hour flight. I signed some mail, and then I went gratefully to sleep. The difference in time is completely incomprehensible to me, but the clock said 6:15 when we arrived at Fairbairn Airport in Canberra. It was sunset and chilly. I gratefully wore my gray coat, stepping out of the plane with a rare sense of excitement and expectation to see this country Lyndon had talked about for 24 years. At the bottom of the steps, we were met by the Prime Minister and Mrs. Harold Holt, both of whom had visited Washington, and the Governor General, Lord and Lady Casey, a remarkable couple, the sort of people that have made England great, and bustling ebulliant Ed Clark and Anne. As we stood ramrod straight for the national anthems, first the Star Spangled Banner and then God Save the Queen, I looked at the bleachers in front of me, filled with people, and behind them, suddenly, in the fading light, I saw a perfect rainbow. Happy augury. And there was a swift little thrill when I first saw troops wearing that tilted Aussie hat. There was a 21-gun salute. Lyndon reviewed the honor guard, and then he spoke. When I first came here a quarter of a century ago, I thought that I had not left home at all. So much did your plains and your hills and your bush country, your cattle and your cattlemen and your sheep, remind me of my native land of Texas. This set the tone for the next 3 days. Here in Australia was the same openness, the same virility, the same self-confidence, the same generosity of spirit that I had treasured in my own country. And then further on, this was repeated very often and for good reason, the Japanese were just 35 miles across the Owen Stanley Range and they were coming in your direction. And then the business of the day. I cannot say that miracles will occur at Manila. I carry no magic wands. And on to the long, hard business of the war against hunger and disease and ignorance. The paper said the airport welcome was a near riot. Throughout, the president gave an impression of controlled power. Though conducting himself with poised dignity, protocol apparently means nothing to the tall Texan. I soon got in the car with Mrs. Holt, and slowly, with many greetings and handshakes, Lyndon and the Prime Minister made their way into the motorcade, and then began the hour-and-a-half-long ride to Government House for the official call on Lord and Lady Casey. On the way, he stopped 9 times to speak to the crowd, and I became familiar with 2 Australian customs. "Good on you, mate," a friendly salutation that in our country would translate, "Good for you, partner." And then the crowd cheering, "Hip, hip, hooray," and "For he's a jolly good fellow." It was quite dark, and Anne and Mrs. Holt were telling me all about Canberra as we went in, but I could see nothing but the faces of people that endlessly lined the road. It was around 8 o'clock when we reached Government House and went in for our official call, which is supposed to last 20 minutes, and which lasted nearly 2 hours. Lady Casey invited me into a private room with her, and we had a few minutes' conversation, quite alone, which I thought was extremely gracious of her. She said, "I want to tell you how much we like you, Mr. Clark. You know, Edward is many men." He is indeed. I was surprised that she had found that out on short acquaintance. She knew Barbara Ward, Lady Jackson, very well, was one of her favorites. She often visits them, she said. And she knew Jackie Cochran, so we had much to talk about. At 74, she flies her plane, as Lord Casey does his at 76. The authorities had asked him to desist. With the respect for law that I like to think is very British, he has acceded. But she said, so Anne tells me, "I agree that Lord Casey's life is valuable to the government, so he has no right to risk it. But my life is valuable only to me, and therefore I intend to keep right on flying." Mrs. Holt told me how the Queen handled crowds. She waved with the left hand for a while and then with the right. She was very interested in Lyndon's response to crowds. She said, "Your husband is a romantic man." He is. Mrs. Holt is a plump, jolly, brisk, extraordinarily natural person. Very refreshing. She's a businesswoman. Has had her own dress shops until he became Prime Minister. We had drinks, and I had a chance to see again Mrs. Waller, who'd been so nice about helping prepare me for this visit. She's the wife of the Australian ambassador to Washington. It was close to 10 when we left Government House. The Holts had invited us on a very impromptu and casual basis to come to the lodge, their residence, for dinner. I was dead tired, Lyndon was exuberant, and so when Mrs. Holt suggested that she give me a plate of her fresh garden asparagus and send me straight home to the hotel, I quietly kissed Lyndon goodnight and slipped out, but not before I had met a young, soft, well-mannered member of their household, a baby kangaroo, right in the middle of the living room. I met also the Prime Minister's son and 2 pretty young daughters-in-law, whose hairdos and skirt lengths were unmistakably 1966. I welcomed getting to the hotel and to bed. Jerry told me we'd go in the back way, as there were some demonstrators at the front door. Later I heard there was a crowd of about 3,000 milling around, some to cheer and some to jeer, the welcoming signs and hostile ones that said, "None of the way with LBJ," and "Try LBJ, war criminal," and wacky ones such as, "I like beer," and "Down with Ireland." I went gratefully to bed, and it was midnight before Lyndon came in.